Hey everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit. Before we get into today's wonderful guests, I just want to draw attention really quickly to my website. It's fairly new, making the impossible possible. Jim, that's probably part of your life too, right? There's a lot of new content there, www.markpattisonnfl.com. I'm also doing an event called the Seven Summits Summit. It's going to be here in Sun Valley, Idaho in September. And it's going to be amazing. And you should definitely look at doing that. We've got great speakers. We're also going to get out in the mountains and climb and really push people. And of course, we are pushing this forward to a great charity called Higher Ground, which is the hat, if you can see this, that I'm wearing this moment. I also have released my book, Finding Your Summit, the same name of the podcast. And it debuted at number one on Amazon. So I'm very proud of that fact. And I've got a billboard, Jim, that's going up in the middle of Times Square, which is always cool. So, on that note, let's get into it. Today, I'm super blessed and I'm super jacked up. And I'm really excited to have this guy on. I just read his book, Jim Sonnyfield. He is the original founder, one of four, of Hootie and the Blowfish. Jim, how are you doing?
Having a grand day, no complaints besides the normal stuff. At age 61, we complain about the stuff that 61-year-olds complain about. So yeah, I got all that going on. Otherwise, man, great to be alive. Great to be on the right side of the grass.
Well, you're saying all the right things, and especially we're going to go through your story, and this is might be a little bit longer than some others, just because I found your story so fascinating. And actually, so for those, I just want to give a quick background. So you grow up in the Carolinas, and you're a soccer star, and you played well, and then you end up going to the University of South Carolina, the Gamecocks. And as we talked about before, going on in the city of Columbia, your state capital. And although you did play soccer on the soccer team at your school, this is where you would eventually meet your other three bandmates who'd go on to a lot of fame and fortune and a lot of tragedy, yet at the same time, a lot of blessings. And I want to get into that. And by the way, just for reference, there's another buddy of mine, Duff McKagan, who's one of the founders of Guns N' Roses. And so we actually played football together growing up in Little League. And so I've known him forever. And he's gone through a similar story, maybe even more hardcore, I'm not sure, than you, but to the point where he'd been drinking so much. And we'll get into this whole story that they said his skin was peeling off and one more drink and he would die. And it was that critical. And he's gone completely clean and sober, and he's leading such a fantastic life now in this kind of this second evolution of Guns N' Roses. So it's really cool to see him out there on the road and doing his thing. But let's start back with this book that you came out with called Swimming with the Blowfish, Hootie, Healing, and One Hell of a Ride. Where did your love of music first kick in? Where did that happen?
I was, I think, born a drummer. We had music in our home, but and my mom was a great influence, and my dad too, because back in the 70s, you only really had access maybe to what was in their record collection or what they were listening to on the radio. So I was influenced by them and a few friends and my siblings maybe, but really, the thing that was going on in my head and in my fingertips and toes was this rhythm that no one else could hear that was probably driving all of them a little crazy. The kid who's tapping his spoon and his fingertips and can't quite seem to sit still because I was hearing a rhythm in my head. I was hearing this, all these different changing rhythms. It was maybe some ADD gone sideways. I had that as early as I can remember. And then listening to some rock and roll, some R&B, and picking out the drums specifically had me picking up items to then see if I could hit the imaginary drums and keep in rhythm with what I was hearing. Elton John and classic rock was kind of what was in my ear at that time. So I started banging along just on the couch with some things that mimicked drumsticks. And it probably drove a lot of people crazy, the noise that can come from one little kid, but eventually my parents maybe decided that therapy for this little guy was more expensive than just getting him a drum lesson to see if that might fix it. And the drum lesson did. It organized what I was hearing. It organized that thing so I could beat drums. They shortly after got me a little drum kit, and I was off to, using it for a better, reason, putting it out in the drums and maybe less tapping in school and in church and at the dinner table.
One of the things I'm thinking about right now, and I've always heard from this guy, so I don't know anything about drums. I play a bad guitar and that type of thing. I play, I grew up, I had 8 years playing the classical violin. But certainly I wouldn't brag about that because I haven't played those things in years. But one of the guys that I heard growing up, and again, I don't know, have a big bass line, but you would, is Stuart Copeland from the Police. And that the kinds of mixing drum combinations was unique in what he could do beyond what many others could. And I just want to know am I going down the right rabbit hole here on his talent and his ability? Like he's like, they talk about Eddie Van Halen, for example, as there's tons of like great guitarists, but he was just a next level. And so I'm trying to make that sort of comparison since you're in the drum world. Would that be a fair comparison just to say that he was next level?
Yeah, he certainly was. And he, like me, is a product of his environment, the influences in his ears. And while I was listening to classic rock and maybe a little bit of country, and then some harder rock as well, being in the Midwest growing up there, Stuart grew up internationally. So he had some influences that were well out of that small pocket of classic rock. He had international influences, and that was represented in his drum style. He also was fierce, aggressive, and of course, discipline is probably the main thing that might get you to any next level, whether you're part of a four-man team or, like him, an even more difficult job, a three-man team. So he's got to make way more noise and have way more of a presence than somebody who's more of a role player. He was one of the three players, and that's a big job. He's one of my idols, and I love him as a crazy person too. I follow him on social media, and he's just a nut. I love his profound attitude about life and music and silliness.
I would say a little bit like my situation, and I'm not gonna like blow my life up because it we all run in certain circles and what you're exposed to. But I've been around a lot of celebrities, and when I first was originally drafted by the Raiders, we had a lot of James Gardner, kind of those old Cary Grant, those types of guys coming in the locker room all the time. I mean, it just wasn't a big deal, right? These guys were always coming around. We were in LA, we're the big team. And so that's just what attracted, those types of people. And it certainly wouldn't surprise me if you, over your course and where Hootie and the Blowfish really blew up, became the number one record. And we'll talk about it a little bit later, but, did you run or cross paths with him and Sting and the band? I know those guys have had breakups and get back together a few different times, but were you able to ever, meet somebody that you also admired, and I'm not going to say looked up to, but certainly respected his talent.
Yeah, I mean, we always, we started doing what we did because we had idols that influenced us, right? That's what we do. We mime the things that give us that spirit and that feeling inside. So yeah, tons of musicians as well, I will say, as athletes, because us four Hootie guys are big sports guys. We grew up playing, and then also have been fans of a lot of different sports. So we used to spend a ton of time together watching it. So when we finally hit sort of popularity, we would have been excited to meet any idol in music as we would have an idol in sports. And it's seen by one of our biggest hit singles called "Only Want to Be With You." We
Yeah.
decided to make the video a play on SportsCenter. So, it's not like we have our big music idols in one of our biggest videos. We have Dan Marino,
Yeah.
and we have Jay Haas, the golfer,
Yeah.
and we're in that mind frame that the people that we love that entertain us, it was musical, and it was the entertainment called sports. So we went f when we were meeting people at the beginning, it was thrilling. We spent a lot of time as we toured our big tours in locker rooms, hanging out, like going back to meet people. They were impressed to meet us, and vice versa. So sports and music sort of ran in line for the members of Hootie and the Blowfish.
Yeah, and it probably has even gone to another level now with the way the intersection of sport and music and entertainment all kind of really collided. You really see this in like the case of Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift, right? And that's just a microcosm of many of the different, the Kardashians hooking up with some NBA player or something like that. And so the money is so giganto now, and really out of control that, well, out of control from my eyes, because I was back in the day when it wasn't like that. But it's just really, it's just really amazing the way those two things have come together. I'm interested in this, in that, and this is for everybody we're going to talk about. These are the hard things, but you were just, it seemed to me like after reading your book from cover to cover, especially in the first half of all your chapters that were there, that you had all this energy. You've got, there's three brothers, I think you're one of three, and so you're always out there playing sports, but you're running hard and you're running fast and all that energy. And then you go on to the University of South Carolina, you're playing soccer, and you're sound like you're a pretty good player. And I'm because I was obviously in sport too, and I went up through that, and there were some people in college and the NFL who just made the wrong choices, and I'm sure they look back on it with regret because it cost them their career. Now, it didn't cost you necessarily your career because you're in music, a transition. But where I want to go to is through the different work you've done over time. Have you ever really isolated that pinpoint issue on why you kind of went deep into alcohol, which would really define your story of who you are today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the journey was long and slow of self-discovery. And it's funny, you can have big successes, you can have big mistakes, you can go through life. And I have worked with a lot of people through my sort of the 12-step model that saved my life from alcoholism. But it's funny, people can go pretty long into their life without truly knowing what makes them tick. They may know things that satisfy them. But as far as the mistakes, we need to see, I needed to learn what was underneath my inability to drink like a normal person, because that's what is suggested, is that there are some ideas that are feeding my actions. Somebody once said, my ideas are the father of my actions. And it's true. There were things in my head that I was thinking that were being manifested as some bad actions or drinking, but I didn't have any idea what they were. So most people end up, it's pain we're running from, pain or fear or pride or self-centered fear and pride. And that's what I discovered along the way as my career blew up. I always liked partying. I love that as a outlet, and many of us as a society use it that way. We celebrate as an accolade with a shot or with a toast or with a couple drinks. And maybe you've had a hard work week. Maybe you've got an award. When you work hard, that's how we sort of celebrate as a community. And that was always the way I did. Except when my career started getting to that point where it seemed like we were on the downside and we weren't ever going to achieve that high again, I struggled emotionally with fear, with pride, with just clawing it. I needed to be back to the time when I felt like things were ahead of me or that we could control things. And I used alcohol because that always worked to give me a good feeling. And so the more I turned up a bottle, or the more I tried to gather other people to celebrate with me so I could camouflage better, the more I was starting to understand I don't do it like a normal person. And that was the hard place I had to come to. And like your buddy Duff has to realize at the be at the to restart, you have to acknowledge, I don't do this like a normal person. And often that evidence is pretty easy for people outside of us to see, but it's hardest for us as individuals to see. So I finally got there at age 40 and had a big restart to point in a new direction. And thank goodness there were people there to sort of lift me up and help me to heal. and understand something about myself. And that was a new beginning for me, a
Well,
brilliant one.
one of the things I always like to really, I say this for myself, and for me, life has become about a life of discipline, and I've had to do that because you have to shut things down. I mean, I'm so super social, and but I purposely leave, or I only have two beers. That's like my max, and they're light beers. So I'm, I just know that I value my mornings more than I do my late nights, and that's something
Yeah.
that's always. I want to ask another question because I thought this was really cool, I want to ask you about this. So early when you were making, this your first big album, which was Cracked Rearview, right? And
Yeah.
so now you're, I think it was during that album that you went in, and the producer that you're with was a big famous producer, and so now he wants to help add some juice to it, so he brings in David Crosby. And so you've got this chapter in there where it talks about, like, on his, so he sings a song with you guys, and it's brilliant, and you guys are like, you can't believe it, you're singing with David Crosby. And by the way, you got one hell of a voice. You're really good. So I just want to say that.
Thank
But
you.
yeah, but David, on his way out the door, according to what I remember from the book, it says something like, remember where you are today and don't abuse it, or something like that. Just kind of like, with all the pitfalls that he had of being the ultimate party guy, it's probably what ultimately killed him. But why that light as a band? I'm not saying just to you, but why the light as a band when he's this big going, like, it's never gonna get as good as what you guys are about to step into. And you're like, yeah, whatever, high five, and he takes off. Like, did you ever look back at any moment, either in that moment? Because it seemed like you guys just, like, you got caught up in all the thing, which anybody would. I mean, you go to number one, like, selling out arenas and having all that power in your hand of telling the audience to do anything. It's crazy. So I'm just trying to get to, like, the impact that David said on his way out the door. It seemed like maybe that would come full circle 20 years later, but didn't really hit you at that time.
Yeah, and that's maybe our youthfulness and the difficulty of being young is like we do have great examples of the right way to go or warnings of wrong paths to take, yet youth says, I got to experience it on my own. So even in that moment of meeting Crosby, it was like we were more thrilled, and my memory was more like, I can't believe we met Dave Crosby. He played Woodstock. You remember those things? And thank goodness I had. For the first time in my life, decided to do some journaling. I brought like a big notebook out to LA because we're going to be there a couple months, and I did daily notes. What did we do today? What song did we record? Who did we meet? And I had written a bunch in there about that interaction with Crosby, which I absolutely would not have remembered otherwise. And that allowed me to write the chapter in the book about what he said, which was just a great warning about, hey, you're a musician. Because of what is happening in your heart, and don't ever forget that, because you're about to enter this thing called the business world,
Yeah.
and it will eat you alive. And that's what he wanted to share with us, because he had made some bad choices in his life. He was sober. He had been in jail. Our producer was also sober. Again, here was a young man who was partying too much already, and I could see people that were telling me that their journey, was a bit of a warning in itself. Yet I didn't. Sort of take it personally. I was too caught up in the moment and maybe distracted by the possibilities of success in music. And so it took me a long time as a result to see those things in myself and to remember, huh, did anyone warn me about this?
Yeah.
I hope, they probably did. And then sure enough, you look back and realize there were a lot of warnings. But it's just an easier place too, I think, in the music biz. And maybe this was Crosby not saying it directly, but indirectly, that it's an easy place to camouflage some defects or some flaws that you might have, right? Because it's not a place where top physical condition or are necessarily the goal. You can slide in, you can have a decent performance, and maybe someone won't notice. You can party too much. You could probably get in the headlines for the wrong reasons. And in music, they don't look at it like the worst thing. It's just, oh, he's a rock star. That's what they do. So it allowed me to camouflage a lot longer too, as the guy who was out of his mind to some degree and didn't have those guardrails that would have helped me.
Yeah, another thing that I found that was really interesting too is that like the environment of which you guys would go in and be like, hey, I'm gonna go cut this album. And so you'd go in and having, whatever drugs and alcohol kind of, fostering inside those studios, it just seemed like I don't know if that's just the way it is. I don't come from that world, so I wouldn't know, but maybe that's just a way, like you're going long hours and into the night, and it's a way to loosen people up and just get the creative juices flowing more or something. I'm not sure, but it's just interesting too that the producers and the people, kind of the handlers around the band, and it's not you guys only. I mean, this is what persists out there. I mean, I don't know exactly if it's like that today, but back when you guys were in your heyday, certainly that was a big part of when you went in and you did this. There was a lot of stuff going on besides just singing.
Yeah, I mean, you have a choice. And at the beginning, I'll say we never tried to mix potions while we were in a recording studio because they cost a lot of money. And whether you were paying for it or the record company was, it didn't matter. You were in a serious place that you knew you had to make a recording that was going to be the thing that people might know you for. So our 5 years between sort of 1989 and before making Crack Rearview, we were always pretty focused. And we weren't partying while we were recording. Even Crack Rearview and the album after that were not big parties because it costs a lot of money and you want to represent yourself well. And as we go down the road further, and certainly touring is a different animal altogether. Touring, I mean, when you go to a concert or when there's 15,000 people in a venue, 14,000 of them, it's a big party night. It's their time to party, and it's easy to get caught up in that. And when you're traveling town to town and you have all that sort of sycophantic behavior, no one's really watching to see if you're living a healthy lifestyle. But eventually it starts creeping into a lot of different places of my life, not just the party and the concert and the touring, but bringing it home. And by the 2000, I was starting a new family and really fearful of which direction my career was going, and I couldn't turn off the partying when I came home, and that doesn't match well when you have a little kid and a wife and then another little kid. It becomes pretty messy, and that's usually a place where interventions start or consequences or people in your band saying, "Hey, are you okay? We're a little worried about, what you're doing these days." So I finally got there, and even there I had knowledge that I was not normal, but it took me probably 4 years to ask for help. It's an insane thing about our humanity is like maybe sometimes the hardest thing to do is to say, I surrender. I can't do this on my own. I need someone else's help. It's such a blow to your pride and ego that I waited a long time.
Well, I think like a lot of things, people like I'm not a motivational speaker. I might inspire a person or two, but at the end of the day, it has to come within that person to wanna. And a lot of kids, I'm talking like losing weight or setting new goals, and that's a lot of the reasons why they start they set some new goal at the beginning of the year, and 3 minutes later, it's out the window on whatever they're doing, right? And that's just, the human brain has to get to that. That threshold, and only that person will tell you when that threshold is gonna show up. Let me ask you about this, which is how in the hell do you write a hit song? Because I'm still waiting to write a hit song called Finding Your Summit. Okay. And I think I'm pretty sure I got it in me, but you had you were you created the song Hold My Hand, which turned out to be one of Hootie and the Blowfish's biggest songs. It might have been the first one, that you happened to bring to the table. And like and you talk about in the book about how like ideas, like in this case, I'm not sure if it took you 20 minutes to write or what it was, but literally just kind of float out of you and onto a piece of paper and on the music on with your guitar. And I'm just wondering, like, how does that happen? Like guys like Paul McCartney and others, who are really prolific and they come up with all these songs. It's really amazing to me how that works.
It is a blessing to have a song, even one song that you can influence people with and inspire them with. I mean, that's again why we started writing songs, because we were fans of music. It gave us that certain feeling. So when I first started to think I might want to put some feelings down on paper and start strumming some chords with a guitar or piano. There wasn't a lot of good, memorable, catchy stuff coming out for a while. Like a sport or a skill like that, it does take some practice. But you can get a little lucky too. It's art. It's not like sport in that in every way. Art is funny. Something sincere or true, even in its basic form, can inspire others, can emotionally touch others. Some of the simplest songs in the world become the most catchy ones because of that same reason. And so, somewhere in the ether, something happens where your honest rhymes and maybe some melodic changes and authenticity just have a possibility of affecting somebody else in a unique way. And so I'd been doing it a few years when the song Hold My Hand sort of came across my fingertips and the lyrics came out of my brain. It was something I was feeling at the time. And they came out at the same time. And that hadn't happened yet for me. And what also was interesting is that, within a few months, I was joining Hootie and the Blowfish. So I had this song I was proud of. So let's say timing also has to do with a success of a song. In my high school gymnasium, there was a sign that said, luck is where preparation meets opportunity. And though I didn't really understand that as a young guy, it made sense to me when things like me writing Hold My Hand is followed by a month or two later joining Hootie and the Blowfish, who want to write their own music. And then we trudge our road. Luck happens again when we get signed by Atlantic Records, and they'd broken Crosby, Stills, and Nash. They'd broken Aretha Franklin, Led Zeppelin. They were a big company, and someone saw us. The timing was right. We'd prepared, and both were happening at the same time. Again, with David Letterman. Our song, Hold My Hand, and the album Cracked Review debuted at 127 on the top 200. It was heading towards the 160s within 2 months. It was going to be an album that was forgotten until luck happened. David Letterman, the biggest late night host, is driving home from work and he hears a little bit of Hold My Hand on the one New York radio station that was playing it. Preparation and opportunity come together. He calls his booker and says, get these clowns on my show to play Hold My Hand. And our 3 minutes and 20 seconds on TV in front of his 5 million fans worked for us. And
Change
it changed
everything.
our trajectory. It's why we're sitting here talking today, 30 years later, 30 some years later, is because that happened.
What's he like?
Letterman is reclusive. He doesn't, you never saw him out and about. He loved his private life and he was pretty shy in those moments playing. We played his show a bunch of times, but he's over for a handshake and he truly was a music fan. Maybe his best feature. I can't call us all friends of David Letterman, but he loved music and he, I think, ended up choosing a lot of the artists based on a song he liked or an artist that he admired. So it was an honor. We got to go back and play his last a few weeks when he was going off the air, he chose us to come in and play Hold My Hand again. I was like, oh, nothing better than that feeling.
In New York City, just he and I mean there was a number of late night talk show hosts. Jimmy Kimmel's out there now and some other guys like that. But it's cool when you get to see a breakout and a lot of those tunes are super catchy too. So they're fun songs. The band has great energy, the way you guys would interact together. Mark on the guitar, Dean on the bass, you back there wailing on the drums back in the day with your long flowing locks, and Darius has got, he's got great chops, and I think you described it really well, that Darius over time would learn how to become a showman because he wasn't necessarily that, like, who would be, right? You're just in little bars and all of a sudden now you're playing the stadiums. So it was just cool how you guys all evolved to come a lot closer, as a band.
I mean, that's what the years of toiling, they call it paying your dues in music, and you play clubs and you get out in front of somebody or sometimes nobody and you learn to build an integrity and hone your craft and work an audience. And back before streaming and the internet, that was the only way. The only pathway was to go write some songs, rehearse them, and bring them out in your van to different cities or campuses for people to hear them. And you sell your little cassette with your songs on it. There was no shortcuts, honestly, to fame and fortune. And there are in the modern era, technology has allowed for the people to get famous pretty instantly. And so I'm glad we had to do it the harder way. Honestly, it built something in us. It built a muscle that would help us down the road. It's helped us to stay together. And mostly being in a rock band is survival after a while. Bands that get to stay together for 20 or over 30 years, or like Hootie and the Blowfish, our 40th year, that's an amazing skill in itself to actually stay together.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. Okay, so we're talking about David Letterman, and that is really what ex blew you guys up in a big way in terms of national exposure. So tell me, what's that like between you as a band and you individually when you're going from, the typical bands are playing all the bars and just, you probably have a small following, especially in Colombia where you guys all attended, but when you're talking about a national audience and you start talking about filling up arenas and you're seeing the stadiums get bigger and bigger, and you're probably touring around initially as the kind of the warm-up band for somebody else that's a lot bigger, and then ultimately you become that band. What was that like in terms of going from that and all the pressure that was coming in and just the celebrity and fame? Like, how did you handle that?
Well, I think the trajectory from in the clubs, we had day jobs for a few years, and then we were eventually able to quit them because our fan base in the Southeast was really growing. We worked hard, we had a manager, we were doing all the right things to be wise and work hard and just try and write great songs and not be lazy. And so I think by the time we got signed to Atlantic, we felt like we were signable. We were a band that had worked hard and proved that we could organize ourselves. And so getting signed didn't seem so surprising. And then there's never a guarantee that your record company will manage to get you on radio. So getting on radio and then Letterman's help was pretty amazing. That was like, that's really great luck, or it's the work of Atlantic Records. And so that felt great, but it got real fast after that. We had been playing, we could probably fill a room on the East Coast with 500, 600 people on a, from Florida to New York for the most part. And suddenly we got signed up to do a couple opening slots way out of our region. So we got to go to the Midwest and open up for Big Head Todd and the Monsters, another band with a great name. We had signed up to do a tour opening up for our idols, which were called Toad the Wet Sprocket, another great name. And that took us to the Midwest and the Far West. And what we didn't see happening at the time, while we were super enjoying being the opening band and you have fewer responsibilities, you're trying to do some press, you're trying to encourage radio in each market. But what was happening was the record buying audience was massively growing, and we were seeing some sales reports, but still none of that was as meaningful as being out on the tour with Toad the Wet Sprocket. So by the time that tour is about halfway or two-thirds of the way through, we are like surpassing all expectations, and they're now planning we're going to go headline amphitheaters, because at the time we were opening for another band in theaters that held a couple thousand people. And while we thought that was a great trajectory, the record company and the record industry knew exactly where we were going. We were, going to hit this crescendo. So by the summer of '95, that was the summer of Hootie, and yeah, some adjustments. It's suddenly you're not prepared to. You need a crew of like 30 people. We have a couple people on our crew, and we drive around in a van, and now suddenly we need to put together an amphitheater show. So there's a lot of work, a lot of meetings, a lot of stressors, but mostly the fun and the fact that you're living your dreams and your album by May of '95 is going number one for the first time ever. You're just pinching yourself. None of the other peripheral things worry you in the least, because You assume they're going to happen somehow, or you'll pay somebody to do them. And it's all good. I mean, it's like to go, we got to start going to Europe, and you get a lot of people taking your pictures. You get a lot of people serving you. And that means also a lot of yes men often. And that's not always the healthy thing when you're not paying attention to everything. So by the end of the, that run, we're having to decide if we're going to make a new record. Suddenly, we're not on the same page. Some of us want to make a new record real quick and get the sophomore jinx over with. Some of us don't. The record company has another idea. Our manager has another idea. And for the first time in our careers, there are questions that we're not agreeing on. And that was the biggest thing to face. And I don't know that we did it well. We're still together, so I guess we did it well enough. But we had never been faced with these big questions and disagreements. And suddenly, looking back to try and make your second record, oh, that's where all the trouble begins. Everybody's got a little money. Everyone's maybe starting more serious relationships, thinking about even families, and the pressure of repeating that cracked rear view is pretty big. I mean, we know how to write songs, but could luck happen again? Is it going to happen again? Because you'd see a lot of bands, and if you pay attention and look back in history, they call them one-hit wonders. And there's nothing wrong with that. It just means a band that somehow couldn't move from that first success in the industry to that next level again. It doesn't mean you're not good at what you do. It means some things didn't line up with the business side, or maybe people already moved on to the next band. Maybe the band had infighting and they don't even last to the second record. A lot of things can go sideways, and we managed to make it to the second record. It didn't do what the first one did. And I think we were okay with that, but then the critics start lashing out. Then our peers in the music business start having their opinions about, Hootie was a fluke and Hootie it sucks or whatever. And that hurt more than anything, having peers that are in the music industry talk a little trash to us in the media. Critics do that for a living. They get paid to be critical, but it hurt when other musicians who had no right to judge our art, let alone make fun of it and claim that it was a fluke. I don't think that's the kind of musicians we are. We are not competitive in that sense with other bands. We think we can all fit.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, the you know this better than anybody, but music trends change. I'm from Seattle, so what came out of there was all kinds of grunge, right? And Pearl Jam and Nirvana and those guys. And and that's kind of where everybody started to lean. And what I love, just my own musical ear, is the classic rock stuff and the Hootie stuff, and that's what I identify with. And that's the reason why there's a lot of these types of stations. They call it boat rock or whatever, or classic music, right? Where it's just the oldies but the goodies, and they seem to be going more and more into that kind of rapish, house music, type phase right now, which I don't identify at all with. So it's just who's ever out there. And you did mention that in the book, you were disappointed that there's a number of guys that you respected out there that were kind of trashing you and. Like what? I don't know. That's just insecurity, because just to be able to not have having to work a day-to-day job and being in a position where you have a lot of fame, but you have a lot of money and you have a lot of other things that come with it, access to certain things. It's just like, who wouldn't want that? And if you play a certain kind of style, then good for you. And if somebody else does something completely different, good for them. It's just, it's not one size fits all. It's everybody can play in the same arena. So it's not a, so anyway, that's the way I look at it. But it's great that you did that. One of the things you didn't, you mentioned that part about on your way up and you're playing, you're the second band, and then you kind of outpaced them, and so now you became the main band of these arenas. But are there any bands that you look back on that you helped pull up? Like that were Hootie before Hootie became Hootie, right?
I mean, we had not only idols, in our region that would have given us a chance in bars, even to open up for them and play a 40-minute set. And obviously, when we got signed, that put us in another realm of possibilities. But when we got to start headlining amphitheaters and realized we had the choice and the ability to lift others up, We certainly did. We loved, and I'm sure our record company hated it. They would have had us bring one of their other Atlantic record bands along that they could promote. And we were like, no, we're gonna go bring each and every band that we ever had a chance to open up for in the Carolinas on tour with us. So we brought bands like that. There were bands that eventually had some success, some larger than others, but regional bands, Dylan Fence from North Carolina, Cowboy Mouth from New Orleans, Craven Melon from Greenville, South Carolina. Edwin McCain is an example of somebody that we brought out because we believed in him, and he had great success with I'll Be, and I Could Not Ask for More, and still has a career 30 some years later. So we always looked at it like I said, not a competition. This is like where we can all live in a space, and if we have success and we rise, we're proud for each other. We're proud of each other. And we never looked at it like if somebody gets up, oh, they took our spot. We deserve that. I mean, just be happy for one another. It's art. You throw it at a wall, maybe it sticks, and if you get lucky, somebody will look at it and pay a few bucks for a CD. And I don't know. We never understood that mentality, and we still kind of carry that today. I think there's a lot of worthy artists we love to promote and we believe in. And we still know some of those bands and play with some of those bands from the late 80s and early 90s that gave us opportunities. And Toad the Wet Sprocket's one of those that we got to, they brought us out and then we brought them out probably less than a year later, because why not?
No, it's just a good way. Like all boats rise at the top, right? And so it's a good thing. Okay, so I'm gonna ask you something. Normally I probably ask this at the very end, but I'm gonna ask you right now, and then I want to jump into some other stuff. But Hootie and the Blowfish, and this was kind of news to me. And again, I read this in the book because a lot of people thought you broke up because Darius went off and did his country thing and did really well with that. And then, 20 years later, I think it was when you guys wanted to have that the 20th anniversary of the Cracked Rearview Mirror album celebration. So you went out for a summer and did that. And I'm gonna make the statement, but you can correct and just talk about the status of Hootie today and the way you guys, but what I took out of it is that in the book is that you didn't break up, but it was just getting there's an intersection of life for people just needed to take a gigantic time out because you were starting a new family, you had a blended family that was going on, and I don't know what was going on with the other guys. I know Darius was off singing this country stuff, but it wasn't a breakup, it was just a time out to let all the dust settle and go off and do all whatever projects you want, raise families, make new music, play soccer, whatever you wanted to do. That's what it was, a timeout. And so why don't you fill in like if that's true or not, and then talk about the, I don't know, wherever the status is today of Hootie and the Blowfish.
Well, we were told early on by a great producer that he said he was warning us as we were new in the industry, there's three things that can break up a band, or that typically are the reasons for breaking up a band. And he said it's women, drugs, or money. And I've seen that to be true over 30 some years. Yeah, it's one of those or all of those that can do it. And we managed, after our success, and then as the 2000s roll around, dealing with some personal issues in all of our lives, mainly the issues are we all change, right? One band member starts a family, the other one gets married, maybe they move to different towns. These things are all really challenging to a band members who used to live in a van together practically, or share a couple small apartments. When you're sort of single-purposed, it's the easiest team ever to be on. But as you grow older and times change and expectations change and people have done different things with their money and their idea of what they want to write is different than the next guy in the band, it's hard as hell to stick it out. And so by 2005, I get clean and sober. And that's a little bit of a challenge. We were always the sort of four musketeers of partying. We partied together, we went everywhere together, and suddenly I had to drop out of that to a large degree. And I spent a few years as we searched for our way. Could we reclaim our fame? We lost our record company, radio didn't want to play our new music, And we were struggling just to define who we were. And by 2008, you know, three of the four of us are divorced. And it's just all kind of fallen apart a little bit compared to the simplicity of the early 90s. And this time, Darius is talking about another solo project. He had already put out a solo project, sort of an R&B flavored thing in 2002, but he thought he wanted to make a little country record. And at the same time, I was thinking, I don't know how long I want to tour. I was divorced and a single dad with two little kids, seeing, oh my gosh, I don't want to give up these guys. And if I stay on the road, I'm not really going to give them the time that I think they deserve and that I want. And so these things sort of happen at the same time. Darius is putting out an inconsequential effort, a country record, and he nor nobody else thinks it's going to be a breakthrough record. And I'm also, right before that happens, coming to the band to say, hey guys, I'm not so sure about touring. I don't know about all the shows we're doing. Maybe we all need a break. Maybe we need to maybe just chill out and reset. And Darius was obviously going to want to spend some time working that country record. Well, two crazy things happened by, I mean, that was 2008 in March. By December of that same year, everything is upside down. Darius has got a number one single, and he's wearing a cowboy hat, and he's in the country charts, and nobody can claim they saw that coming. And that's a big change for us, a lead singer who's got a hit with a solo album in a different genre. And I'm now at that same time in that December getting remarried after my first divorce. But I'm not just marrying anybody. I'm marrying someone I've fallen deeply in love with in a short period, who happened to have been married to our guitarist previously.
It's
And
insane.
so these two things are flipping the script on Hootie and the Blowfish. And so we end up saying, hey, well, we'd already sort of said, let's pull back. And now it makes even more sense that the pullback is just to everybody get used to their new roles. A singer who is about to start a legitimately hugely successful career that Hootie hadn't really seen in a decade. We hadn't had sales like he was about to have. And I was getting in a new marriage and now five kids, three stepkids and two kids. We were like, this will be the last tour until we feel like touring again. So we had decided that probably by, you know, midsummer. And yeah, it's facing change that is the biggest thing for a band to survive in the long term. And that is different. Going back to the sports thing, you know, it is hard for an athlete coming out of one main sport and with an aging body or a broken body to face that reality. And we had a similar thing. We weren't the biggest new band. We were an old band wondering if we would ever get back to the old times and the big sales and the big venues. And so we felt like sort of not semi-retiring, but just pulling back to say, we got to figure this out. And I think,
Without breaking up.
yeah, absolutely. We said, this is important to us. So, the one thing we did to answer your original question is we have a Hootie and the Blowfish Foundation that we had started. We've been doing charity golf and charity concerts in our state because we felt it was important to give back and use our impact. And so, we said, we're going to keep the charity shows. They happen every spring. And we said, we'll keep those. And then Darius can tour as much as he wants. We'll all learn what being off feels like. And so we did that, and we 1 year became another year. You know, suddenly it's 2009. Darius has got a hit record, multiple number one singles. 2010 rolls around, 2011. Eventually, he's got a Grammy Award with one of the biggest country songs in the last 20 years, whose name is escaping me right now. The song that
Wagon Wheel? Is that the one you're
thank
thinking
you,
of?
that one I can't believe I can't think of that. It's in my head, but yeah, so it continues to change. And you know, at some point we did our we do our two or three shows in the spring for the charity. It felt great. I supported Darius's career. I just loved that he had success and redefined himself in a very difficult way. Not only a rock guy going into his country genre, but a man of color going into the country world and having the biggest success ever. I loved it. And honestly, the more time he spent out there being successful, it sort of signified that I would have the time I wanted in our big, complicated new family. So
So
we got about.
where are you today with all that? So
Yeah, so
is it
that
still?
was, if you go from his album release and my second marriage at the end of 2008, we spent 10 years in that mode. So we got to 2000, basically 19, and decided let's, pull the wagons out. It's the anniversary of the, release of Cracked Rear View, more than a couple decades earlier. And we'll test the audience. We've starved them for a decade. Let's see who's out there. And it blew our minds. We thought we'd maybe be going out and playing to, I don't know, 5 or 10,000 people. And we were putting 16, 18, 20, 24,000 people in my hometown gig in Chicago, Illinois. It blew us away, and it helped ask or answer the question, would we ever have a chance at success again? Because radio wasn't coming back. They played all of our old hits, and that's great. But it's going out and selling tickets and t-shirts and hats that money you can put in the bank. And so it was tremendous to have that happen. And we were really lucky because it was our, let's say, that was 2019. What was that? The 25th anniversary of Cracked Rear View. And we did an incredible tour that was rose high above our expectations and worked a new album until the end of the year. And people had said, you should go out and do dates in the winter or the spring or do it again. And we're like, no, let's just be happy with what we did. And what happens 3 months later? COVID. And anybody that had wanted to tour that year, they got blown out because all the venues shut. So we were real lucky to have our big anniversary year happen in 2019. And we sort of got through COVID like everybody. And we pulled out the wagons again in 2024 and did that same thing again. We're playing amphitheaters again, just like 2019, and the crowds came out huge, and it just felt so good to know that it wasn't just a mirage that happened in the mid-90s. It was real, and the fans continue to enjoy our music. They moved from cassettes to compact discs to downloads to streaming, and our streaming numbers have continued at an incredible pace, showing that people do really like Hootie and the Blowfish. And sometimes you might look back and think it was just a moment in time, but it's been able to be something that we've gotten to live and support our careers for a long time.
And do you have something coming up in the summer of 2026?
No, in the summer of 2026, I'll be watching as many World Cup soccer games as I can
Okay. Yeah, I know you're a
across
big
our
soccer
country.
fan. Yeah,
Yeah,
that.
Darius will be
Okay.
touring. He does a tour every summer, and we'll wait for our next Hootie opportunity.
So, okay. All right. So I wanted to get that out of the way. Thank you. I want to go back now to your transition. Okay, and reset that just a little bit because you said that you got clean and sober and all that kind of stuff, and you really felt your bottom and then your path forward, and then you get remarried, happens to be with to your guitarist of Hootie and the Blowfish ex-wife now, and you guys, and I'm so happy for you because things don't always turn out perfect, and you guys were able to really blend that and make that work. But more importantly, it sounds like you were able to preserve that relationship with Mark. And at some level, I don't know if you're, I would, your best friends or not, but certainly enough that you can keep the band together and writing songs and you just find a new way going forward. And eventually everybody gets over it. So it's just a lot of time that's in there. But you've gone into, and this is where I was listening to you, just your voice, not the whole Hootie thing. But you really leaned into kind of the Christian music radio, and you've really got a beautiful voice, and you're the guy usually back on the drums with Hootie, and now you go to the forward of the stage and you're playing guitar and you're a really good guitarist too. And so
Thank
I
you.
just yeah really I really enjoyed listening to some of that. So tell me about that. Tell me about your, I would think it'd be a bit of a transition from going from the guy behind the stage and behind the three dudes in front of you to now you're in front, and kind of like you talked about that evolution with Darius in terms of he really had to learn how to become a front man and entertain the audience and talk to him and all that kind of stuff. Like what, how have you leaned into that?
Well, I being clean and sober and realizing that, and then remarried and wanting to dedicate home time, it sort of put me in a spot of what am I going to what am I going to do creatively, you know? And I think the darker years of my alcoholism had me writing towards themes of loneliness and detachment and fear. And those songs, if I look back at my titles, even the ones that made the Hootie records were, you know, they were down. They were not hopeful. They were not celebratory. And when I finally started writing again, probably 2009 and 10, I really had a spirit about me that was, I just want to write about the celebration of life. I really got a good fo
Right.
new foundation of thinking, sort of a redemption where I had some better tools for relationships. I knew that the obsession for alcohol was behind me. I wasn't going to pick up a drink. I would have recoiled like it was a hot flame. I knew that I was free from that. And that freedom signified a new music. And so I was also sort of reinvigorating the life I didn't like. Being raised as a little Christian kid and thinking, I want to make that work. I always thought it was the wrathful God, and it scared me, and I turned away from it pretty quick. And I wanted to make some of that work. So, along with the principles I learned in the 12-step model, I started writing some new music, and I put out three EPs that were, you know, specifically contemporary Christian themed rock records, and became the lead singer. And it wasn't hard to write them, and I felt authentic, and a lot of people were surprised. Whoa, Sony's come out all Jesus-y, and I'm sure it was awkward for other people. It was awkward for me because when I made my first record and recorded it in a studio and loved it, I realized, wait, I have to go out and sing this in front of people out loud. I've never been a lead singer. I don't know how to stand up there. And it was very awkward. The transition, and I write about it in the book, was like I had this great, amazing admiration and gratitude for what somebody like Darius does as the guy up front. Because when there's a screw up or a bad note, nobody looks at the drummer or the keyboardist. They look right at the singer. And as a solo artist that didn't even have a band behind him, I was playing acoustically and leading a message and new music. Man, there's nobody to deflect that any mistakes or hesitation from. And all the pressure is on that guy at the center of the stage. And so I loved, like, this is harder than I thought. So I spent a bunch of years sort of practicing that craft, the craft of speaking in public, commanding a message that's not just authentic, but useful too. You know, I wanted to say something. So I do a lot of speaking gigs and engagements, but I feel more comfortable now, years later, on a microphone. I can go out and sing and speak and have a positive effect on people, give them hope towards some recovery. And it's not just alcoholic, it's, you know, relational codependency or pornography or gambling. The 12-step model works in a lot of those realms. And the positive music that I bring, including some of the Hootie stuff, Hold My Hand, you know, songs that are positive and uplifting, those really lift the message, the spoken message. So it's a powerful story that can be very impactful. And hey, as much as I want to go out in a tour bus and party with thousands of people, I'm also pretty happy as a guy who's grown a little older to do something a little more mellow, a little something I can control. I'm not in a bar at 12 o'clock at night. I don't need to be there. I do gigs at normal times. They're non-smoking. They usually happen earlier. So it's quite satisfying.
See, that's why that's where you'd find me, right? I'm that boring guy too, right? But that's how you accomplish things, and that's a life of purpose and not just, partying to the next thing, to the next thing. And to me, that's super, super important. The other thing that really impressed me about you, Jim, is your commitment and your dedication to raising your kids. And that drove a lot of this whole thing. Like when you went to the band and said, I think we need a big ass time out. And those kids down the road are going to respect you for that, because you could have taken a different path and said, like, let's keep this thing going and push that hard. And I'm sure everybody would have jumped in on that. But, it was just super important that you just kind of had a big, gigantic reset in your life, and also 100% focus of not being on the road all the time and doing those things that can be very destructive if you don't have that self-discipline.
Yeah, and I don't think I would have been able to make a coherent decision had I not had a few years of sobriety and the principles that bring that sobriety to me. I wouldn't have really been clear-headed. I could never have done it when I was drinking because I was too addicted to the fame and fortune and that sort of the accolades that were still on us, even if the audiences were shrinking. So, I owe it all to that. And even writing the book had to come years later. I don't think I would have written a decent memoir in my 30s or 40s or maybe my, I guess I wrote it in my mid-50s. You need to learn a little bit about life and yourself and have some real failures. It's not about the successes for me as much as it is acknowledging and dealing with the failures. How do you respond when you fail or come up short and you're limited? That's what is your integrity and your character. And so I wanted to write something that was useful to talk about. Hey, I'm the guy that you thought was all famous and had cool hair from Hootie, and here's the ways I've suffered, and here's the solutions I use to get to a better place.
Love that. My book we talked about before, Finding Your Summit, How to Build Resilience and Faith, which you can identify with to rise above life challenges. My whole life is really built on the valleys I've been in and how I've been able to climb out. And I've got my little system, but we have that very much in common. Okay, tell me where people can find you. I went and checked out your website today. It's really cool. Like I said, you're out there public speaking. You'll bring your guitar to an event if need be. You've got a great message. You got this book that's out that I read from cover to cover and just was really blown away by it. It's really interesting, really cool. So let's start there. Where can people find you?
Yeah, my new website is jimsonnenfeld.com. Not only does it show my music and my book and sort of my messaging, and you can reach me there directly through the contact. So if you want to book me for a variety of speaking, singing, house concert, you can reach me there. My Facebook page is where I'm a little more active, just what my life looks like in 2026, some family stuff, some Hootie stuff, a variety. And you can get linked into that from my website. And if you're interested in a big speaking gig, if you probably hit Jim Sonnenfeld speaker, I bet you could find me on a couple different agencies in the United States that would be happy to book you as well. Trying to do some corporate stuff and try and get on podcasts. Thanks for having me, Mark. This has been tremendous to talk and yeah, interact with someone who's been through similar versions of this journey, right?
Yeah.
We have summits, we have valleys, and we're just trying to stay up as high as we can, where the air is clear and the view is good, right?
I love it. Love it. Love it. All right, everybody. Well, Jim, again, thanks so much for coming on. Superstar, really, in every single way, as being a human being and giving back and being a great mentor to your kids and just really showing what is possible. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. There he is, the one, the only Jim Sonnenfeld. Thank you.